Chapter 31. Lynx, Arthur Donathern, you remember, is under an engagement with himself to go and see Mr. Irwin this Friday morning, and he is awake and dressing so early that he determines to go before breakfast instead of after. The rector, he knows, breakfasts alone at 9:30, the ladies of the family having a different breakfast hour. Arthur will have an early ride over the hill and breakfast with him. One can say everything best over a meal. The progress of civilization has made a breakfast or a dinner an easy and cheerful substitute for more troublesome and disagreeable ceremonies. We take a less gloomy view of our errors now our father confessor listens to us over his egg and coffee. We are more distinctly conscious that rude penances are out of the question for gentlemen in an enlightened age, and that mortal sin is not incompatible with an appetite for muffins. An assault on our pockets, which in more barbarous times would have been made in the brusque form of a pistol shot, is quite a well-bred and smiling procedure now it has become a request for a loan thrown in as an easy parenthesis between the second and third glasses of claret. Still, there was this advantage in the old rigid forms, that they committed you to the fulfillment of a resolution by some outward deed. When you have put your mouth to one end of a hole in a stone wall, and are aware that there is an expectant ear at the other end, you are more likely to say what you came out with the intention of saying than if you were seated with your legs in an easy attitude under the mahogany with a companion who will have no reason to be surprised if you have nothing particular to say. However, Arthur Donathern, as he winds among the pleasant lanes on horseback in the morning sunshine, has a sincere determination to open his heart to the rector, and the swirling sound of the scythe as he passes by the meadow is all the pleasanter to him because of this honest purpose. He is glad to see the promise of settled weather now, for getting in the hay, about which the farmers have been fearful, and there is something so healthful in the sharing of a joy that is general and not merely personal, that this thought about the hay harvest reacts on his state of mind and makes his resolution seem an easier matter. A man about town might perhaps consider that these influences were not to be felt out of a child's storybook, but when you are among the fields and hedgerows, it is impossible to maintain a consistent superiority to simple natural pleasures. Arthur had passed the village of Haslip, and was approaching the Broxton side of the hill, when, at a turning in the road, he saw a figure about 100 yards before him which it was impossible to mistake for anyone else than Adam Bede, even if there had been no gray, tailless shepherd dog at his heels. He was striding along at his usual rapid pace, and Arthur pushed on his horse to overtake him, for he retained too much of his boyish feeling for Adam to miss an opportunity of chatting with him. I will not say that his love for that good fellow did not owe some of its force to the love of patronage. Our friend Arthur liked to do everything that was handsome, and to have his handsome deeds recognized. Adam looked round as he heard the quickening clatter of the horse's heels, and waited for the horseman, lifting his paper cap from his head with a bright smile of recognition. Next to his own brother Seth, Adam would have done more for Arthur Donathern than for any other young man in the world. There was hardly anything he would not rather have lost than the 2 feet ruler which he always carried in his pocket. It was Arthur's present, bought with his pocket money when he was a fair-haired lad of 11, and when he had profited so well by Adam's lessons in carpentering and turning as to embarrass every female in the house with gifts of superfluous thread reels and round boxes. Adam had quite a pride in the little squire in those early days, and the feeling had only become slightly modified as the fair-haired lad had grown into the whiskered young man. Adam, I confess, was very susceptible to the influence of rank, and quite ready to give an extra amount of respect to everyone who had more advantages than himself, not being a philosopher or a proletar with democratic ideas, but simply a stout-limbed clever carpenter with a large fund of reverence in his nature, which inclined him to admit all established claims, unless he saw very clear grounds for questioning them. He had no theories about setting the world to rights, but he saw there was a great deal of damage done by building with ill-seasoned timber by ignorant men in fine clothes making plans for outhouses and workshops and the like without knowing the bearings of things by slovenly joiners' work and by hasty contracts that could never be fulfilled without ruining somebody. And he resolved, for his part, to set his face against such doings. On these points he would have maintained his opinion against the largest landed proprietor in Loamshire or Stonyshire either, but he felt that beyond these it would be better for him to defer to people who were more knowing than himself. He saw as plainly as possible how ill the woods on the estate were managed, and the shameful state of the farm buildings. And if old Squire Donathorne had asked him the effect of this mismanagement, he would have spoken his opinion without flinching, but the impulse to a respectful demeanor towards a gentleman would have been strong within him all the while. The word gentleman had a spell for Adam, and, as he often said, he owned abide a fellow who thought he made himself fine by being cocksy to his betters. I must remind you again that Adam had the blood of the peasant in his veins, and that since he was in his prime half a century ago, you must expect some of his characteristics to be obsolete. Towards the young squire this instinctive reverence of Adam's was assisted by boyish memories and personal regard, so you may imagine that he thought far more of Arthur's good qualities, and attached far more value to very slight actions of his, than if they had been the qualities and actions of a common workman like himself. He felt sure it would be a fine day for everybody about Hayslip, when the young squire came into the estate such a generous open-hearted disposition as he had, and an common notion about improvements and repairs, considering he was only just coming of age. Thus there was both respect and affection in the smile with which he raised his paper cap as Arthur Donathorne rode up. "Well, Adam, how are you?" said Arthur, holding out his hand. He never shook hands with any of the farmers, and Adam felt the honor keenly. "Could swear to your back a long way off. It's just the same back, only broader, as when you used to carry me on it. Do you remember?"
"Aye, sir, I remember. It 'ud be a poor lookout if folks didn't remember what they did and said when they were lads. We should think no more about old friends than we do about new ones then."
"You're going to Broxton, I suppose?" said Arthur, putting his horse on at a slow pace, while Adam walked by his side. "Are you going to the rectory?"
"No, sir, I'm going to see about Bradwell's barn. They're afraid of the roof pushing the walls out, and I'm going to see what can be done with it, before we send the stuff and the workmen."
"Why, Birch trusts almost everything to you now, Adam, doesn't he? I should think he will make you his partner soon."
"He will, if he's wise."
"Nay, sir, I don't see as he'd be much the better off for that. A foreman, if he's got a conscience and delights in his work, will do his business as well as if he was a partner. I wouldn't give a penny for a man as 'ud drive a nail in slack, because he didn't get extra pay for it."
"I know that, Adam. I know you work for him as well as if you were working for yourself.
But you would have more power than you have now, and could turn the business to better account perhaps. The old man must give up his business sometime, and he has no son. I suppose he'll want a son-in-law who can take to it. But he has rather grasping fingers of his own, I fancy. I dare say he wants a man who can put some money into the business. If I were not as poor as a rat, I would gladly invest some money in that way, for the sake of having you settled on the estate. I'm sure I should profit by it in the end. And perhaps I shall be better off in a year or two. I shall have a larger allowance now I'm of age.
and when I've paid off a debt or two, I shall be able to look about me.
You're very good to say so, sir, and I'm not unthankful.
But Adam continued, in a decided tone, shouldn't like to make any offers to Mr. Birch, or T have any made for me. I see no clear road to a partnership. If he should ever want to dispose of the business, that'd be a different matter. I should be glad of some money at a fair interest then, for I feel sure I could pay it off in time.
Very well, Adam, said Arthur, remembering what Mr. Irwin had said about a probable hitch in the lovemaking between Adam and Mary Birch. We'll say no more about it at present. When is your father to be buried?
On Sunday, sir. Mr. Irwin's coming earlier on purpose. I shall be glad when it's over, for I think my mother'll perhaps get easier then.
It cuts one sadly, to see the grief of old people. They've no way o' working it off, and the new spring brings no new shoots out on the withered tree.
Ah, you've had a good deal of trouble and vexation in your life, Adam. I don't think you've ever been hair-brained and light-hearted, like other youngsters. You've always had some care on your mind.
Why, yes, sir, but that's nothing to make a fuss about. If we're men, and have men's feelings, I reckon we must have men's troubles. We can't be like the birds, as fly from their nest, as soon as they've got their wings, and never know their kin when they see 'em, and get a fresh lot every year. I've had enough to be thankful for. I've always had health and strength, and brains to give me a delight in my work, and I count it a great thing as I've had Bartle Massey's night school to go to. He's helped me to knowledge I could never have got by myself.
What a rare fellow you are, Adam, said Arthur, after a pause, in which he had looked musingly at the big fellow walking by his side.
Could hit out better than most men at Oxford, and yet I believe you would knock me into next week, if I were to have a bottle with you.
God forbid I should ever do that, sir, said Adam, looking round at Arthur and smiling.
Used to fight for fun, but I've never done that, since I was the cause of poor Gil Tranter being laid up for a fortnight.
I'll never fight any man again, only when he behaves like a scoundrel.
If you get hold of a chap that's got no shame nor conscience to stop him, you must try what you can do, by bunging his eyes up.
Arthur did not laugh, for he was preoccupied with some thought that made him say presently,
I should think now, Adam, you never have any struggles within yourself.
I fancy you would master a wish that you had made up your mind it was not quite right to indulge, as easily as you would knock down a drunken fellow who was quarrelsome with you.
I mean, you are never shilly-shally, first making up your mind that you won't do a thing, and then doing it after all?
Well, said Adam, slowly, after a moment's hesitation, no.
I don't remember ever being seesaw in that way, when I'd made my mind up, as you say, that a thing was wrong.
It takes the taste out of my mouth for things, when I know I should have a heavy conscience after 'em.
I've seen pretty clear, ever since I could cast up a sum, as you can never do, what's wrong without breeding sin and trouble more than you can ever see.
It's like a bit o' bad workmanship you never see and o' the mischief it'll do.
And it's a poor lookout to come into the world, to make your fellow creatures worse off instead o' better.
But there's a difference between the things folks call wrong.
I'm not for making a sin of every little fool's trick, or bit o' nonsense anybody may be let into, like some o' them dissenters.
And a man may have two minds, whether it isn't worthwhile to get a bruise, or two for the sake of a bit o' fun.
But it isn't my way, to be seesaw about anything.
I think my fault lies th other way.
When I've said a thing, if it's only to myself, it's hard for me to go back.
Yes, that's just what I expected of you, said Arthur.
Who've got an iron will, as well as an iron arm.
But however strong a man's resolution may be, it costs him something to carry it out, now and then.
We may determine not to gather any cherries, and keep our hands sturdily in our pockets, but we can't prevent our mouths from watering.
That's true, sir, but there's nothing like settling with ourselves as there's a deal we must do without eye this life. It's no use looking on life as if it was treadless and fair, where folks only go to see shows and get fairings. If we do, we shall find it different. But where's the use of me talking to you, sir? You know better than I do. I'm not so sure of that, Adam. You've had 4 or 5 years of experience more than I've had, and I think your life has been a better school to you than college has been to me. Why, sir, you seem to think of college something like what Bartle Massey does. He says college mostly makes people like ladders just good for nothing, but he holds the stuff as is poured into him. But he's got a tongue like a sharp blade, Bartle, as it never touches anything but it cuts. Here's the turning, sir. I must bid you good morning, as you're going to the rectory. Goodbye, Adam, goodbye. Arthur gave his horse to the groom at the rectory gate, and walked along the gravel towards the door which opened on the garden. He knew that the rector always breakfasted in his study, and the study lay on the left hand of this door, opposite the dining room. It was a small low room, belonging to the old part of the house, dark with the somber covers of the books that lined the walls. Yet it looked very cheery this morning as Arthur reached the open window. For the morning sun fell aslant on the great glass globe with goldfish in it, which stood on a scagliola pillar in front of the ready-spread bachelor breakfast table, and by the side of this breakfast table was a group which would have made any room enticing. In the crimson damask easy chair sat Mr. Irwin, with that radiant freshness which he always had when he came from his morning toilet. His finely formed plump white H, and was playing along Juno's brown curly back, and close to Juno's tail, which was wagging with calm matronly pleasure, the two brown pups were rolling over each other in an ecstatic duet of worrying noises. On a cushion a little removed sat Pug, with the air of a maiden lady, who looked on these familiarities as animal weaknesses, which she made as little show as possible of observing. On the table, at Mr. Irwine tilde S. elbow, lay the first volume of the Fowlis Aeschylus, which Arthur knew well by sight, and the silver coffee pot, which Carol was bringing in, sent forth a fragrant steam which completed the delights of a bachelor breakfast. "Hallo, Arthur, that's a good fellow. You're just in time," said Mr. Irwin, as Arthur paused and stepped in over the low windowsill. "Carol, we shall want more coffee and eggs, and haven't you got some cold fowl for us to eat with that ham? Why, this is like old days, Arthur. You haven't been to breakfast with me these 5 years." "It was a tempting morning for a ride before breakfast," said Arthur, "and I used to like breakfasting with you so when I was reading with you. My grandfather is always a few degrees colder at breakfast than at any other hour in the day. I think his morning bath doesn't agree with him." Arthur was anxious not to imply that he came with any special Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.